This is Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's check in and find out what's happening with the veterans here in Northwest Indiana. Tom Pappas, who's with the City of Portage Veterans Committee, back with us for a monthly look at, first off, what is coming up with the Veterans Committee meeting tomorrow night in Portage.
Tomorrow night we have Mr. Sawinski presenting on Honor Flight Chicago. Mm-hmm. We also have a video, Speak Up, which is very important for veterans to view. Gives them some ideas what they should be doing when they interact with the VA. And lastly, we have Kevin from the Vet Center coming in to do dog tags for veterans that have lost their dog tags.
That's important. I think made people figure that, okay, I'm out of the service. I don't need my dog tag. There's some people like us that have kept our dog tags. I still have mine on a key ring, not in my pocket right now, but in my jacket for that reason. I like to have it. It's kind of reassuring, although, and I realize, well, that's, I think except for paperwork, that's about all I've got left of my time in the service.
I even have my P-38 from Vietnam I've saved.
Oh, really? Well, you're lucky. I mean, if you have that, yeah. It's just, it depends what you want to say. But I guess there are really instances where maybe having your dog tags, besides just for personal reasons, that probably come in handy. I mean, you have other more official paperwork that you have to turn in, especially when you're working with getting things through the VA and the like. But it's probably better to have them.
I would imagine a set of dog tags might get you off a traffic stop.
Well, it's hard to say. We're not going to say that it will, but you never know. You just never know. So people that want to get their dog tags replaced can find out more about that at tomorrow night's City of Portage Veterans Committee meeting. And by the way, any veteran in Northwest Indiana is welcome to attend.
Yes. Come in early if you want your dog tags.
Okay, very good. The legislature finished up their session just a little while ago, and you've got some information here about some of the measures that came through the Indiana House and the Indiana Senate. In particular, you mentioned about what's in the new budget, the new two-year budget that the lawmakers passed and the governor signed into a law.
Yes, and what's important about this, other than what was passed, is the fact that there was a call to action issued through the Big Four, the Veterans Service Organizations, the Portage Committee. We sent out a call to action. Over 30,000 calls and emails were sent and made to the General Assembly, the legislators, and that's why the budget provisions for veterans was passed. There was a big hang-up, and the veterans spoke up, and they were rewarded for speaking up.
Some of the things in particular that you mentioned here that are in the budget, we want to talk about some of these items and let people know if they don't have a copy of HEA 1001, that at least we can mention that there are some very interesting things that do benefit veterans
yes.
in the bill.
Oh, well, it all benefits veterans in one way or the other. What's important is the funding that was added. At least to me, the one most important thing was the funding added to support the veterans organizations. Let me look here. The American Legion got $200,000 in addition to what they're already getting.
Mm-hmm.
$200,000 for the DAV, the VFW, AMVETS got another $100,000, VVA got $100,000. This is important. Most of that money goes to support their service officers. Mm-hmm. And there's a big uptick in veterans placing claims. The Vietnam veterans were all getting older, were retiring. They're looking at the health issues that they have, and they say, well, if I can qualify and get a couple more bucks for retirement, it would be nice.
Yeah. I know, too, that the biennial budget also has some interesting things, increases in particular for military income after the age of 60, where about $6,250 added to a military retirement income deduction
yes.
from your gross income taxes. So it's another benefit, too, that you'll save taxes.
Yes. If you're getting a pension or if your spouse is getting a pension, if you pass and your spouse gets some money, It went up from $5,000 to $6,250. The governor wanted it all to be exempt, but we didn't get enough phone calls. So next time, let's hope we get more phone calls.
Well, we're going to talk with Dan Carden, who's the State House reporter with the Northwest Indiana Times. He is, of course, the fellow who spent a lot of time at the Indiana State House here during the session and talk about different issues that affect Northwest Indiana. And he in our conversation, we talk about how important some of these items that didn't come up this session are more than likely to show up again in 2018. So I'm sure that this will be a great opportunity. There'll be more time to focus on these things because you don't have the lot of work that's involved in dealing with the roads and bridges, the infrastructure funding that they work on, plus just the two-year state budget in general.
It's and the problem is it's going to take a lot of work before the next budget that it has passed. To get what we really need for veterans in the state.
There were a number of other bills besides what's already in the two-year state budget that the General Assembly passed this session, and I know that there's a list here I have of some of these bills that made it through. Run down the list, if you will, Tom, and tell us what the ones that other people can take a chance to look at if they want to go on the state legislative action
websites
and find out more about
those
bills.
Well, there's Senate Bill 307 about veterans' preference for employment and training. That's a good one. Senate Bill 382 about veterans' driver's licenses, and that's to let spouses have something on their license that they are the spouse of a veteran. There's the House Bill 1394, waiver of local occupational license fees. As I remember, if you're a nurse or any kind of professional that has to pay a licensing fee, if you're married, the spouse of a veteran, those fees are now waived, which could be a nice chunk of change. The same with 1396 teacher licensing, and House concurrent resolution. I did not look that up. Conductor training program for veterans. I'm not sure what that is.
I think they may have to do with the railroads, I believe.
I hate to say that, but you're probably right.
I think it is because I remember seeing something about it and it was in great support by the railroads in Indiana because they wanted to see the opportunity for not only having more people that could be trained as conductors for the trains, we're talking freight as well as passenger.
Yes.
The idea is that the veterans should have a chance to be able to apply for these jobs, but of course they have to be trained for these jobs too.
Well, and the employers are increasingly looking at the fact that veterans are reliable employees. Every businessman I've spoken to is having problems with employees showing up every day. They know a veteran will show up every day.
One other note, too, that besides the legislature, that some things have going to help veterans here. On June 24th, Aspen Dental is going to offer some free dental care. Tell us, if anybody's interested to check that out. They just have to make a phone call and find out more about that, I understand.
Yes, and I encourage a veteran to make the call yesterday because this is going to fill up, and the number to call is 844-277-3648. That's 844-277. Is that a 3 or an 8?
That's a
3648.
3648, yes, that's right.
Okay.
I had to look at my sheet too, as well, too, yes.
Call now because if you need any dental work, you'll have to find out where you'll have to go to get the work done. And it's limited. They're going to fill up quick, so don't delay.
Now, there are a lot of Aspen Dental locations all across Northwest Indiana in all of the counties, but in most of the counties at least, but I'm sure there will be a limitation, maybe only one or two locations may have to set up.
One of my committee members went online, and he found out that there are a lot of them that aren't participating.
Yeah.
So you need to call.
That's fine. There's been a recent rash of problems that people have run into with the Veterans Choice Program. in particular, I guess, yes. We have a scam out going on out there. And the word has come out from the Veterans Choice Program to everybody involved here that we need to pass along. It's very, very important that you know what's going on and know how to be able to beat the scammer. You don't want to get nailed by this one.
No, and I got an email alert directly from the Jesse Brown director's office. A lot of veterans call the number as an 800 number, when in fact the number is 866. Mm-hmm. You dial the 800, and they tell you they'll give you a $100 rebate if you give them your credit card number. It's a scam. It's a shame that veterans are getting caught in this. Remember, the real number to call is 866-606-8198.
And that's the number for the Veterans Choice Program.
Yes.
We know about that. It's very important.
Don't dial it as an 800. You could get scammed if you're not careful.
Now, if you unfortunately, you can always, obviously, if you get that, that should be your clue that you're being told something that is not the case, that the Veterans Administration is not going to set you up and put you into a possibility for a rebate
right.
of any kind.
Right.
That's just not the way that the Veterans Administration Department works.
But a lot
they
of,
want to be sure that you get service, but they're not going to offer a rebate.
No, but the problem is a lot of veterans don't think. Mm-hmm. You know, and I hate to say it, there's too many veterans like too many regular civilians are their own worst enemy sometimes.
Speaking of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, some good news has come out. I have some concern. We always have talked here on our opportunities to talk about the problems that pop up with the VA healthcare system. A lot of the problems that come up with the clinics and the hospitals, in many cases, is because of they're being short-staffed.
Yes.
There's always a problem with healthcare and having enough people working in hospitals and clinics, but the VA has seen a rather acute problem with short staffing. And we've gotten word that from the VA department that there had been, I guess, plans for a hiring freeze, but that in turn has been lifted. So effective immediately, any hiring restrictions are no longer in place for the Veterans Health Administration's medical facilities. That includes, of course, the hospitals and the clinics, as well as non-medical positions, too. So
yes.
People that work in the clinics, people who work in hospitals like the Jesse Brown VA Hospital in Chicago and other places, and for Veterans Benefits Administration regional and field offices, they'll be, if there are openings to fill, they'll be looking for people to fill those positions.
And there are a lot of positions. If you go online, you'll find there are many positions open, and they all have a veteran's preference, meaning if you're a veteran, and if I remember right, a spouse of a veteran, mm-hmm. you get preference for being hired. I'd like to go back to the Choice Act, something yep. veterans need to know. The country's divided in two, with Tri-West handling the western part of the country, HealthNet handling the eastern half. Tri-West, for over a year, has had their employees in every VA medical center to handle choice program problems. I was at a town hall in South Bend last week, and I found out that the Fort Wayne Medical Center now has an employee from HealthNet there. There are no employees in Jesse Brown or any of the medical centers this way. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping it will be corrected because the VA cannot do a whole bunch with choice issues because Congress took them out of the picture. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping, and everybody needs to, let's all pray for something like that to happen.
Once again, let's talk briefly here about the people coming in for tomorrow evening's City of Portage Veterans Committee meeting. Let people know if you're interested in
sure.
showing up, come to Portage to the park, and you can find out a lot of information there. You can find
yes.
out a lot for any particular meeting, but this meeting coming up in particular.
Well, again, we have honor flight presentation. We're going to talk about veterans speaking up. We have a video on that. And also, you can get your dog tags that you lost 50 years ago.
Which has happened, I'm sure. Once again, the City of Portage holds a Veterans Committee meeting once a month. It's the first
Wednesday
of every month.
5 o'clock.
And it's held where?
At Woodland Park, 2100 Willow Creek Road.
Tom Pappas is a member of the City of Portage Veterans Committee. We've talked about a lot here in this particular conversation today, and of course we'll come up with more for next month as well, too. Tom,
oh, yes.
Thank you for coming by today.
Thank you for having me.
Residents in East Chicago, Munster, and Lake Station public school districts are going to the polls today to speak out about the requests that their school districts officials are making, asking for approval for tax increases. The reasons for the increases vary in each district. There's one district that is trying to bounce back from an external crisis that is not of its making.
Last year, school began in East Chicago with a crisis, the lead crisis that has impacted hundreds of families, forced city officials to shut down Kerry Gosch Elementary School. The students needed a place to hold class, so they were moved into a shuttered school. School officials did that in 5 days. State dollars follow the student, so without those students, they'll need to find a way to replace those funds. Dr. Paige McNulty is superintendent of the East Chicago Schools.
Yeah, so we've lost 401 kids and counting so far. From our school, which we had 4,500 kids starting the school year. We're down to 4,100 students. So that's a revenue loss of over $3 million so far.
The answer is a referendum. They'll ask East Chicago residents to pay more to replace the funds that they have lost because of fewer students.
I think that when you have strong schools, you have a strong community. And when you have a strong community, you have strong schools. And so in order for us to continue to build our schools and make them strong, we have to have revenue and capital. One of the things that I'm proud of is we are investing back into our schools heavily with the new curriculum, new programming. So those are some of the reasons that I'm asking for the community to support our schools so that we can have our kids stay in our town and give back. The things that we're doing, that we're putting in place to move our grades up are in place now. So the new curriculum, professional development for our staff. So every Wednesday is late start Wednesday in our school district now. Our staff is getting 4 hours a month of professional development on how to use the curriculum, on how to use instructional technology, those types of things. And I believe that we're well on our way to improving our programming.
In East Chicago, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
The Purdue University Board of Trustees decided last week to acquire the academic operations of online educator and testing company Kaplan. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Chris Marisi-Vitsa tells us that the decision came at a very special board meeting in West Lafayette.
President Mitch Daniels says the acquisition allows Purdue to reach people around the world, including the one-third of Hoosiers who are working but have no education beyond high school. He says it's a problem that's perplexed state government and education leaders for a long time.
What are we going to do about those who missed their opportunity the first time around and will not have a fully productive and successful life unless somehow they add skills and credentials?
Daniel says the deal came together in a little more than 5 months after Purdue leaders realized that starting an online education program from scratch would be expensive and less efficient than acquiring the resources of an established firm. Purdue will pay $1 for Kaplan's academic assets and will keep the first $10 million of profit for each of the first 5 years, according to documents filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission. In return, Purdue has signed a long-term service agreement for Kaplan to provide certain services. Kaplan, which has been owned by the Washington Post Company for more than 30 years, will transition its for-profit model to that of a public university. Kaplan chairman and CEO Andy Rosen says his company and Purdue share the same mission, that of educating people who typically don't have access to higher education.
You know, we've built this institution over a long period of time. We are turning it over to someone. You want to make sure that the party you're turning it over to is someone you feel absolutely confident in, and that was easy here.
Pending approval from federal, state, and university accreditation agencies, Kaplan's 32,000 students, 3,000 faculty and staff, and 15 campuses will shift to the Purdue brand and be operated by a separate board established by Purdue. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Marisi-Vitsa in West Lafayette.
The United States is the only developed country that doesn't require any paid leave for new parents. The Federal Family and Medical Leave Act protects workers from losing their jobs if they take time off to care for newborns or for loved ones who are sick. But that's the extent of what is offered here in Indiana and in most states. A bill that Governor Eric Holcomb recently signed sets up a summer study committee to examine the possibility of paid family and medical leave at the state level. In the meantime, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier reports that a growing number of employers are offering paid time off in those particular situations.
Jill Phillips needs all of the energy she can get.
We have a 10-year-old
a 7-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a newborn.
The mother of four is finishing up her last week of time off with her newborn son while juggling the needs of her three other children at the same time. It isn't easy. We meet at a McCordsville park, and her kids interrupt our interview a few times.
Dalton.
Phillips has her hands full, and she's got a great sense of humor about it. When she had her first three children, she was able to take 12 weeks off after giving birth. She switched jobs before having her fourth child and is a staff member now at Indiana University in Indianapolis. She doesn't qualify for the paid parental leave policy. It's currently only offered to faculty.
I ended up taking off 3 weeks of vacation, or 3 weeks vacation, combination of vacation, sick time, over a 3-week period. So I didn't work at all those 3 weeks. And then starting the fourth week, I started working from home part-time at 24 hours. So, and then I took, you know, the rest of it, like 16 hours unpaid.
Phillips says it was a hard adjustment financially. She's going back to work full-time Monday when her son is just over 2 months old. IU recently announced it's expanding its fully paid parental leave program to include staff members like Phillips. The new policy goes into effect July 1st and gives both parents up to 6 weeks off for the birth or adoption of a child.
I just think it's wonderful that they're going to offer that, because it's hard to, you know, to just juggle all of it.
Purdue University offers up to 6 weeks of paid parental leave for those who've worked for the university for at least 1 year in a benefits-eligible position. Indiana State University allows employees to take up to 12 weeks of unpaid FMLA to care for a newborn or adopted child, but fewer than 50% of workers in the U.S. even qualify for FMLA. That means many people's jobs and benefits aren't protected if they take the time off.
I know that we're offering basically nothing here.
That's Democratic State Senator Karen Tallien. She and two other lawmakers are urging their colleagues to consider taking action at the state level. The National Partnership for Women and Families gave Indiana a near failing grade last year on its annual assessment of paid family leave policies. Governor Eric Holcomb signed a bill Tallien co-authored this session that means a summer study committee will look into the possibility of setting up a voluntary paid family leave program in Indiana.
That an employer and an could offer to his employees, they could both contribute to a kind of short-term disability package. And then when someone needed FMLA, they could apply and get that.
Erin Macy is a policy analyst with the Indiana Institute of Working Families. She says other states have explored the option of voluntary paid family leave programs.
With a voluntary or mandatory insurance program, employees or employers could pitch in a small amount of money to a statewide insurance pool, and that money would be used to pay employees when they need wage replacement for family leave.
Opponents of paid family leave policies argue they can be hard on small businesses, which Macy says makes voluntary programs attractive solutions. But she argues offering paid time off to support families can benefit companies long term.
We know especially younger generations are really looking at these benefits in order to make decisions about employment.
Phillips admits she took for granted that most companies offered paid time off for parents.
A friend of mine gave birth last year, and she went back to work full time after 3 weeks. And that is just tough.
She's grateful she's been able to spend 8 weeks at home with her newborn, even if some of that time was spent working. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
2017 General Assembly session's done, and the governor is now taking a look at the bills that have come out of the session, signing some of them off, and he's still working on that, I understand. And to find out the latest, let's check in with Dan Carton, who's the State House reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Dan, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Happy to be here.
Well, if you will, fill us in on what the governor signed lately and what he is looking at that is likely to get signed into law. And we know some of these bills that he's already, of course, signed off on are very important to Northwest Indiana.
Absolutely. He actually has about, I want to say, like 10 bills left to sign. Mm-hmm. He's expected to sign them Tuesday. And then we'll know where everything stands, whether it's going to be signed or vetoed or allowed to become law without his signature. Of those, the still outstanding, probably the most interesting for Lake County people would be the Lake County election precinct consolidation mandate. This is an effort led by some notable Republicans in Lake County to eliminate these small election precincts that you find in Hammond, Gary, and East Chicago and consolidate them with some of their larger neighbors so they can reduce the cost of putting on elections, because if you have fewer precincts, you can you don't need as many poll workers, you don't need as much polling equipment. Democrats see this as an effort to suppress the vote. Governor Holcomb hasn't said what he plans to do with it yet, but we should find out later today, probably.
This is one of these measures. We know that the local election board wanted to try to avoid having to take effect here. To even have it all was they're trying to make some changes locally, but not apparently to the liking of the state.
Yeah, there was an effort to do it sort of without the mandate, but there was some skepticism in the General Assembly about whether or not that would actually happen, because when a similar law was enacted in 2014, the Lake County Democratic Party took the case all the way to the Supreme Court, and while the case was still pending in court, the law actually expired, and nobody got around to consolidating anything. So the thinking is the mandate will force it to happen this time. But it's also, you know, it's also an issue of state versus local control over something important like elections.
One of the other measures I know that has come up, and in fact, we've had a chance to talk with its sponsor, State Senator Andy Melton, here just the other day, was, of course, Senate Enrolled Act 567. That's the big bill with a lot of big changes, mainly added to an existing bill that, of course, have a big impact on the Gary Community School Corporation. But I know that that, of course, is one bill, but there have been some others that have come up that have some big impacts as well on Northwest Indiana. Fill us in on those, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Probably the one that will affect everybody in the region and all over the state is the road funding legislation that Governor Holcomb signed last week. This is a whole package of tax increases and fee increases that take effect, or at least one starting July 1st. So July 1st, the price of gasoline in the state is going to go up 10 cents a gallon to help fund road improvements. And then starting next year, everybody will pay an extra $15 at least when they register their car to help support local road projects. This is something that the state has, you know, I don't think anybody would deny that Indiana's roads are in not so great shape, and this was the only way that they could figure out how to pay for it was to raise taxes and ask Hoosiers to pay a little bit more to get better roads.
Now, we know that's one of the things that's, of course, part of the next 2-year state budget that is also in effect right now, or will take effect officially this summer. But it has been, of course, signed off by the governor after the lawmakers had approved it. What else are we likely to see as some changes in Northwest Indiana, besides seeing the roads and the bridges, with any luck, make some improvements there?
Yeah, the budget includes $6 million a year to fund the state's share of double-tracking the South Shore line between Gary and Michigan City. This has been a project 100 years in the making, and the money is actually there for it this time. The state's going to pay $6 million a year for the next 30 years, and that's going to be combined with some local and federal money to do this project, to expand capacity, to speed the travel times. And really, it brings places like Michigan City within an hour on the train of Chicago, which is huge because, you know, then it's closer than Joliet, it's closer than Aurora. You know, these are places where people have been commuting to Chicago for years on the train. Now they can live in Michigan City for half the price and still get to their job in less than an hour. So this could really transform the region in a lot of positive ways.
Couple of things involving education. We know that the state did approve the opportunity for the school city of East Chicago to be able to keep some money back that they had lost because of the last-minute changes they had to make with the loss of students at Kerry Gosch Elementary School, shifting people around and the like in residences, as well as youngsters in the schools. And I guess the state has at least given East Chicago School District a chance to keep some of the money or make up some of the money that they're going to lose.
Yeah, Indiana has a pretty rigorous policy of education money following the child. So every kid in a school has a sort of a value attached to them based on, you know, their educational background, their educational needs, where they're where they're going to school. And if the kid leaves the school, so if a kid leaves East Chicago school for another district, the money follows the kid. So East Chicago would lose that money immediately, which can really hurt a school. And you see it, you know, basically all over the state, because, you know, kids don't leave in nice organized groups where you can eliminate an entire grade or, you know, get rid of four teachers. You might lose, you know, three kids in third grade and four kids in seventh grade, and, you know, you're out $60,000, but you can't really afford to get rid of a teacher because you still have the kids left behind.
Yep.
So what they passed what's called a hold harmless. So East Chicago is going to get to use its student count from 2 years ago for the next 2 years to make sure the district isn't what they saw as unfairly punished because of this lead issue that the school really had nothing to do with. These are people who were forced to leave their homes, forced to leave the district. So the idea is, let's not bankrupt the district at the same time.
And I know that of course, is a concern even today because of residents and voters in East Chicago, as well as in Munster and in Lake Station, are going to the polling places to answer yes or no to some of the referenda questions that are out there to take a look at. And East Chicago's got money on, and as well as the other school districts have money matters that they'd like to have resolved as well, too. So this is very important for East Chicago, to say the least, in addition to trying to win a vote or two from the electorate, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. This will save about $3.5 million for the next 2 years, or ensure that they get an extra $3.5 million that they otherwise wouldn't get. So that'll cushion the blow of losing those kids. And if the referendum passes, the district will get more money to make some improvements that they think is necessary.
We're talking with Times State House reporter Dan Carton about some of the stories that he's reported from the General Assembly as it finishes up the 2017 session, and these bills that are now signed into law by Governor Holcomb, or will be at least under review as he finishes up his bill signing and review process. One measure I know, Dan, that you reported on here not long ago that the governor had gone ahead and signed into law was what's called House Enrolled Act 1031, and the fact it was a locally sponsored bill. Tell us what that's all about, because it involves local governments and financial records that may not be well kept.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. So every year, every other year, the State Board of Accounts does an audit of every local government. So your cities, your school districts, townships, even weird, sewer districts. Everybody gets audited by the State Board of Accounts. Up until now, those audits have identified problems and made recommendations for corrections, but unless there was like actual theft of government money, the State Board of Accounts couldn't really do anything to get the local governments to correct their audit issues. This House Enrolled Act 1031, which was sponsored by a few region lawmakers, Hal Slager and Rick Niemeyer in the Senate, put some teeth in the audits. So if you're a local government official and you're told by the State Board of Accounts that you're not accounting your money properly or you're not making a daily deposit like you're required to, the second time that happens, you're going to have to the local official will be forced to come up with a corrective action plan. And then if it continues, the General Assembly has this thing called an audit committee that can force the local officials to come down and basically, get a pretty serious talking to, or they can even refer the issue to a county prosecutor, the attorney general, to look into possible prosecution for, official malfeasance.
One of the other stories you had not long ago involving Hoosier law enforcement agencies and about the importance of your DNA. And I guess it's a very interesting bill that went through, and the governor apparently signed into law, must have thought it was pretty interesting as well. Tell us about this measure, please.
Yeah. So right now, when you're convicted of a crime, the Department of Corrections takes a DNA sample from you, puts it in this, what they call a felon DNA database that the state police use, and they run it against, other crimes, national, crimes, unsolved murders, things like that, just to see if, somebody they've picked up is connected to these other crimes. This new law would take the DNA sample upon arrest. So if you're arrested for a felony, the local police will take your DNA sample and send it to the state police and start investigating you based on that, even though you haven't been convicted of any crime. It The legislation passed overwhelmingly in the General Assembly, but there's some question about its constitutionality because you're basically taking what is supposed to be an identification tool. So, you know, if you think of DNA like a fingerprint or a photograph, that's to be used for identification purposes. They're actually going to use it for investigation purposes. So you could see, you know, you could see a situation where the police suspect you of a crime and arrest you, you know, for another crime that you may or may not have committed, but they can get your DNA, and suddenly the first crime they suspect you for, they have the evidence that they couldn't get before.
I can see where this is going to be a serious matter for the courts eventually, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think not before too long it'll be... It'll be in the court.
Probably not long after the bill takes effect on July 1st. Well, Dan, tell us, we've had recently an article about what each side seems to think about how well the 2017 General Assembly session went. Fill us in on what the Republicans feel did well and didn't do well, and what the Democrats think the same.
Sure. I mean, you know, Indiana is run entirely by Republicans. The House and the Senate have Republican supermajorities. The governor's a Republican. So everything that became law was supported by Republicans. So obviously they think the results of the session were great. They got a long-term road funding plan. They doubled funding for preschool. They made some changes to the state's workforce development programs to try and better coordinate all these different programs across a lot of different agencies. They enacted a balanced budget. They increased funding for education. So they think this was, the greatest session since sliced bread was legalized. But, you know, the Democrats see things a little differently. A lot of Democrats supported those issues as well. There were Democrats who voted for the budget. There were Democrats who voted for the road funding bill. But they look at it as more of a missed opportunity. The state hasn't raised its minimum wage in 10 years. Mm-hmm. The Democrats want to do that. There was an effort this year to enact a hate crimes law. Indiana is only one of five states that doesn't enhance a penalty for a crime if it was motivated by bias towards the victim. They wanted to do something with that, and it didn't go anywhere. There was a two-year study of legislative redistricting that concluded last year that was supposed to produce some legislation this year, and that measure didn't go anywhere. And then Indiana still hasn't done anything with LGBT civil rights. So a gay person in Indiana can be fired from a job or kicked out of her house just for being gay, so long as you don't say you're motivated by religion. Yeah. So any other reason.
Well, do you think that maybe the Democrats and maybe even a few Republicans that are supportive of some of these issues that didn't come up this time will make a stab at it in 2018?
Yeah, I'm sure these will all be back in 2018. They're kind of perennial issues. Sometimes they just, you know, sit there for a long time. But, you know, Democrats do have a way of making headway. They're part of the road funding bill transfers all the sales tax that the state collects on gasoline to roads. That's something that the Republicans didn't want to do initially, and the Senate Republicans resisted up until the very end. But the idea came from the Democrats, who came up with their own road funding plan, and they said, hey, you know, we've got all this money that we're that people think they're paying in gas taxes at the pump, and it's going to just the general fund. Why don't we put that into roads before we start raising more taxes?
So you're saying we might see some of these as well as issues in the next political campaigns as we get up to another midterm election season.
That's true, and, you know, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. You know, the Republican Party platform specifically opposes tax increases, and, you know, you've got a whole state house full of Republicans who just approved them. So
that's right.
Will they get primaried by, you know, more conservative Republicans? Will Hoosier voters just accept the tax increases because they think road funding is necessary? You know, will 2018 be a wave year for Democrats up and down the ticket because of what's happening nationally? It's going to be an interesting time.
Well, Dan, thanks for your views. Thanks for the information you passed along here. We'll check back in with you soon, I hope.
Sounds great.
And we're talking with Dan Carton, who is the State House reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Indiana's $100 billion manufacturing sector is regrouping after a legislative session that they hoped would focus on workforce development. And while some advocates applaud the reform that did pass, geared toward using the education system to fix labor shortages, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek reports others say that there's a lot more work to be done.
Indiana is the most manufacturing-dependent state in the country, and it ranks high on a lot of business-friendly metrics. Low taxes, a central location, and plans for upgrading roads and infrastructure that just passed the state legislature. But State Representative Mike Braun, a Republican who owns a logistics company in Dubois County, says this self-styled state that works lags in one key area, training enough workers to fill open jobs.
It's kind of reached a boiling point of where industry may have to, you know, consider actually relocating outside the state if, in fact, they can't get a trained workforce to fill these jobs.
But with a low unemployment rate, the state's $1 billion in annual spending on programs to solve that problem isn't making much of a dent for the manufacturing sector, which has thousands of high-paying openings.
It's between $1 billion and $1.5 billion worth of income that we're not realizing. That would actually move the needle a little bit on economic growth.
But with a low unemployment rate, the state's $1 billion in annual spending on programs to solve that problem isn't making much of a dent for the manufacturing sector. It has thousands of high-paying openings. So Braun and fellow lawmakers went back to the drawing board and passed a bill that aims to align all those programs with what employers need. It asks the Department of Workforce Development to figure out which business sectors have the most openings and the best wages, what kind of training those open jobs require, and what existing training programs will help fill them. They'll look across high schools, college courses for credit, and private certificate programs. The final touch is a workforce-ready grant program to help Hoosiers of all ages and backgrounds enroll in those programs and get hired, says State Higher Education Commissioner Teresa Lovers.
If you come back and get a certificate in an area that we know will improve your ability to get a good job and meet the employer needs, we'll make sure that you can afford to do that.
The bill asks state agencies to update their workforce development data every 2 years and to keep track of how many good jobs the programs are helping to fill. Lubber says their efforts need to keep pace with the economy and help people build upward in their careers.
The world of work is changing so dramatically that it is highly likely with automation and artificial intelligence and robotics that many of these jobs will change and we'll have to continue to give people the opportunity to scale up.
Employers know this too, says Indiana Manufacturers Association lobbyist Andrew Berger. That's why he says the industry wanted to gain more of a voice through this year's reforms. On that front and on the timeline of these reforms, he says they're disappointed.
We had hoped for some steps that would have an immediate effect or at least start changing the system to more of an employer-driven delivery mechanism, but that's not what happened.
The IMA's immediate solution was a tax credit for businesses that train new workers. It was amended out of the final workforce development bill. For the long term, though, Berger says they're pleased with these education reforms, as long as the state does enough to involve the industry in identifying high-value jobs and training programs.
We want it to be as nimble as possible because what, you know, an employer in Lafayette needs is going to be different than what an employer in New Albany needs.
And the longer it takes to funnel money and then trained workers through high school, college, and private STEM education programs into open jobs, the worse Berger says things will get. He says about 20% of the average factory's workforce could retire today if they wanted to, meaning Indiana will have 15,000 jobs to fill every year for the next decade in manufacturing alone.
I mean, that's when it really becomes a crisis, is when the workforce is not just unable to expand, but is actively shrinking.
The state will take a couple of steps to plug the gap by the end of this year under the new legislation. In October, the governor's office will put out a master plan for realigning the state's many workforce development efforts. Then in December, the DWD will release its first round of data about where open jobs are and what training programs can fill them. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek.
This is Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by Indiana Humanities. This series is part of the Indiana Humanities Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. As long as humans have existed, sharing resources has been an issue. Wars have been waged over the sharing of drinking water and countless other natural resources. So the way people view sharing resources has always been with a pretty bleak outlook. An economist named Victor Forster Lloyd first named this phenomenon the tragedy of the commons. That was in 1833. According to Vlad Tarko, economics professor at Dickinson College, the tragedy of the commons means that sharing resources is always doomed to fail.
So it's known as a tragedy because it's assumed that people are just unable to properly manage the resource. So it's like the inherent logic of having a collective action where everyone basically has the incentive to free ride on what others are doing. So then no one actually takes responsibility for managing the resource properly.
But is that true? Are shared resources really always doomed to fail? In the 1960s, some people didn't agree that it was, but they didn't know how to prove it. That's where this week's Hoosier innovator Eleanor Ostrom comes in. Eleanor was trained as an economist and a political scientist at UCLA. Very unusually for an economist, Eleanor went into the field to collect data to see how a community dealt with water resources in California. She interviewed scores of people to hear how they negotiated the distribution. And what she found out revolutionized the way political scientists and economists think about human behavior.
So she showed that actually people do come together and create these rules for managing the resource, so they are not stuck in the tragedy of the commons.
After getting her PhD from UCLA, she and her husband Vincent came to Indiana University, which would be their home for the rest of their lives. Just like Eleanor did with the water issue in California, she looked at all kinds of commons issues. But it's how she did that that was so unusual.
The most striking thing is how she combined many different methods. While most researchers usually just stick with one method and basically are stuck with whatever problems that method has. So she, by contrast, looked at all kinds of different methods to look at how communities self-organize to solve problems.
Eleanor was so passionate about solving problems, she didn't care whether she used mathematical, scientific, or anthropological methods to solve them. In fact, she sought out the methods of all different fields in order to come to her conclusions. It was this unusual interdisciplinary approach that made her the first woman to win the Nobel Prize in Economics. One of Eleanor's most influential and innovative projects was to compile data from over 1,000 commons cases across all kinds of disciplines. In her own words, she said that for the first time, political scientists were in there talking to economists or sociologists or engineers or historians. Normally, people who studied Africa didn't talk to people who studied Asia. And if you did fishery, you didn't know anything going on about water. But she solved this by creating a database that could look at evidence of commons cases across all disciplines. And she and other experts could really make conclusions about human behavior from this.
So part of what she did was to create this kind of language to understand studies across disciplines. Right, so you have like an anthropologist now can talk with an economist about this kind of problem and they can understand each other.
Creating this language and the database was overwhelmingly difficult, but it worked, and it became one of the first projects of a center that Eleanor and Vincent founded, nicknamed the Workshop.
That workshop that attracted a lot of people from all over the world.
The enduring work of the workshop in Bloomington, Indiana, ensures that the incredibly effective interdisciplinary approach between the sciences and social sciences lives on, and that experts can continue to discover truths about the world. Indiana Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives by creating and facilitating programs that encourage Hoosiers to think, read, and talk. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, and I'm Sandra Burin.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Coming up tomorrow, we'll bring you a conversation with Gerard McClendon and his guests from his Counterpoint program on Lakeshore PBS. We hope you'll join us for that tomorrow here on Regionally Speaking.